right, we're ready for Genesis chapters 10 and 11 in our study tonight. And with chapter 11, we finish the first section of the book of Genesis. As we've outlined it here, there are two major sections. We label that as early history, covering creation, the fall, the flood, and then we have the Tower of Babel. And that's in 10 and 11. And then we begin patriarchal history. But for what it may mean to you, this tonight, when we get through with chapter 11, will end universal history, as some have called it. So not just early history, but universal history. Because it's what we have is the beginning of all things, starting with the creation. And then we finally get to the point that the nation, the number of people is quite large. And then the world is destroyed by a flood. It rebuilds. And now we're seeing the rebuilding of that. And then there is the dividing into nations that we're going to see tonight with different languages and in different nations. And then it's as if this were on camera. The camera zooms in on one nation. Now, there are going to be other nations that have effect or have dealings with this one nation, but it's going to focus upon the Hebrew nation, upon the descendants of Abraham. So this is the end of universal history. When we get through with chapter 11, what that may be worth to us. Just going to review briefly these chapters because we have some ground to cover. Chapter 1 was obviously dealing with creation, the 6 days of creation. Chapter 2, man in the garden. Chapter 3, the fall of man, Adam and Eve's sin. Chapter 4 is Cain and Abel. Chapter 5, a number of people are mentioned. So this is the genealogy from Adam to Noah, and then chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 we could put as a unit of chapters dealing, you hear me talk about unit of chapters a lot, dealing with what? The flood. So in chapter 6, the reasons and preparation for the flood. Chapter 7 is the flood itself. The world is destroyed by flood. Chapter 8, Noah comes out of the ark. And then chapter 9 was our last chapter. Yeah, God's covenant. And we see the rainbow and God's covenant. He wouldn't destroy the earth by flood again. And then there's Noah's drunkenness. All right, now we're ready for chapter 10 and chapter 11. Here's a little chronological note for what it may be worth to you. And this, without this note or without this understanding, you don't have to make a note about this, then the chapters don't make sense. And that is the separation of the people by languages occurred before the development completely of the nations that are mentioned in chapter 10. So we like to think the Bible is in true chronological and whatever happens in this chapter happened before that chapter, the next one. And that's not the case. All scattered through the Bible, that's the case. And we have that right here. And you say evidence of that. Well, let's get ahead of ourselves and notice that at verse 5, it talks about the sons of Japheth and then the sons of Ham and the sons of Shem. Each one of those sections, three sections in chapter 10, end on the note that they were divided according to their language, to each his own language. We come to chapter 11 in beginning, there's all one language. It's kind of like we went back in time, and we do. And so that's inserted for historical note, and there's a purpose in the story of the Tower of Babel, or the dispersion of the nations would be a better title of that. And we'll get to that in a moment. So what it is worth to us, that's a little historical chronological note, that took place before the full development of what goes on with the nations of chapter 10. All right. So chapter 10, question number one, what's chapter 10 about? All right, the descendants of Noah, Noah's sons, or the nations that develop from Noah's sons. And so we have dividing into the tongues in chapter 11, and we'll come to that concerning the Tower of Babel and the confusion. But what we have in chapter 10, on a cursory reading of this, this would be one of those chapters you get to, like Nehemiah 3, like the genealogy of chapter 5 of Matthew 1 and Luke 2 and so, etc. You say, that's just got a bunch of names, let's just skip over that. This is a powerful chapter. This is an important chapter. And you're going to see why as we go through if you haven't already looked at it. So here we have three divisions. We have the sons of Noah, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And we're going to see the nations that came from them. And so let's look at the sons. And so that's not a hard outline to remember. So we're going to move on to this little diagram. And so we begin here with Noah. This is a family tree beginning with Noah. And then you have Shem and Ham and Japheth. Now the little cross on Shem and then Arphaxad represents the lineage through which the Messiah is going to come. And that's important because typical of Noah's, of Moses' writing is he takes a family or sons of the descendant of a certain person, in this case of Noah, and dispenses with those that are not connected with the Messiah, and then he goes and focuses on the Messiah. Make sense? Not necessarily in chronological order of their birth, but he deals with Japheth and deals with Ham, and then he focuses on Shem. Make sense? All right. Now, we're going to look at these sons, and then we're going to look at the nations, so I'm going to flip back and forth. And so let's go ahead and get a kind of a feel of this. Here's your little legend over here. And so we're going to look at these various colors that have reference to where these sons settled in the nations that came from them, because that's told right here in our text. So let's go back to our little diagram here of our descendants of Noah. And we focus, first of all, on the sons of Japheth. And how many sons did he have, according to verse 2? He's right here. Seven sons. And so they are listed right here in verse 2 as being Gomer and Magog, from which we get the name Magog, mentioned a number of times in the Bible. Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. And those are his seven sons. Now, there's only two of those that are focused upon more in detail. And let's just take a little note of those at verse 3 and 4. There's Gomer and Javan that are mentioned in verse 3 and 4. And let's go ahead and get verse 5, and then we'll talk about where these all settle and the significance of those. These seem to be, as we'll get ahead to our little map, this is the group that settled around the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. So this has reference to the people that settled in this region who were further away from those who were the descendants of Abraham. And so some have suggested that Moses dispensed of them early, and then he'll talk about those that were closer to the children of Abraham, and then he focuses on the children of Abraham because that's the focal point beginning in chapter 12. All right, at verse 5, though, these were in the coastlands of the people of the Gentiles, everyone according to his own language, according to the families, into their nations. And so by the time we get to verse 5, they have already divided into languages, plural, and nations, plural. Make sense? So already the event of chapter 11, 1 to 9, has taken place. Now exactly where that fits, we'll talk about perhaps a little bit later. So what you see here, and at verse 2, we're not going to talk about every one of those, but this is generally what's thought to be where Gomer, the family of Gomer and Magog settled. Media or Madai was from which the Medes who later formed with the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire, came from the descendants. There was Meshech settled in this region, and then part of Gomer's family and descendants right here in what would be called later on as Asia Minor. But generally this region around the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea would be the sons of Japheth. Make sense? Several nations came from that, from his descendants. More about who those are, we'll diagram here in just a moment. All right, let's go to Ham. How many sons did Ham have? Four that are mentioned at verse 6, and depending on your translation, it may read different from mine. There was Cush and Mizraim, and you say, well, no, mine says Egypt. Mizraim is the transliteration of the Hebrew word for Egypt. So both are correct. And so those are those who are from Egypt, Cush, Put, and Canaan. All right. Now let's get where they are. You see the family here from Ham, and let's see where they are said to have located. So go back to our key here. So it's this color here. And as you know, I'm colorblind, so I'm assuming that's some kind of, I know it's a bright color. Is that yellow? All right. Whatever color that is, yellow, somebody said. All right. So Canaan obviously has reference to the people who settled in the land of Canaan right here. They also settled, now notice Nimrod we're going to talk about in just a moment, in Shinar, which is the region around Babylon. And the we'll talk more about Babylon just a little bit later. But then they settled in the region of Cush down here in Nigeria, and here's Egypt, and then Put over here in Africa. So that's the region in which they settled. Now I want to go back to verse 8, 9, and 10. What do we know about Nimrod? I think we had a question about Nimrod. Question number 2, who was Nimrod and what did he do? He was a mighty hunter, which means he became, and this was somewhat customary of the time, that quite often great warriors came from great hunters who defended, who hunted for game, but also hunted and killed wild animals in defense of their family, and so consequently many of them became great warriors. In the process, notice that the text says, and the beginning of his kingdom, the International says it was the first centers of his kingdom. In other words, he established centers of kingdoms, and he mentions Babel. Now, that's significant because we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel a little bit later. That's that was in Shinar, as we just mentioned here a moment ago, which is the region of Babylon. And so that's where Babel is going to be built. The Tower of Babel is going to be built. That's the land of Babylon. And then there's also, he built Nineveh as well. And so consequently, he's building kingdoms in various places. Now I want to jump down to verse 14. Also coming out of him are the Philistines. Now not every nation is going to be significant to us, but the Philistines are going to be quite significant when we get to the time period of David. And so they're going to be descendants of Ham. They're also, notice at verse 15, the Canaanites, and then there's the number of the Canaanites that settled right here in what we refer to, obviously, as the land of Canaan, Palestine. There's the Jebusites. What's significant about the Jebusites? They were the ones who occupied the city of Jerusalem. Yeah, this is Jerusalem. Then we see the Hivites and the Hamathites, etc. There are various that we'll get to when we get to the conquest of those that were driven out. And let's see, what else do we want to mention before we get to the end of that section? At verse 20, verse 19, the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon as far as Gaza. So in other words, that whole region that we call the land of Canaan or the land of Palestine. But then verse 20 ends this as the other one. They were divided according to their families and by their nations. So there are a number of nations that came out. So you have much of Africa, you have Ethiopia, you have part of the region close to the Persian Gulf, and then you have the land of Canaan on up into what we would call the region of Assyria. Would be the land that is taken by the sons of Ham. Various nations. How many nations do we have in total? About here, I'm not talking about now, I'm talking about in this context. There's 70 nations that are thought to be found here in Genesis 10 and 11. Now we're more interested in the descendants of Shem. Why? Abraham came from that, which means the Israelites came from him, which means our Savior came through that line. So that's why we're interested in. That's why it seems, and I hadn't thought much about that till recently, that Moses again dispenses of this family, and he deals with them quickly, and then focuses on the descendants of Shem. And so he does more of that even in chapter 11. All right, so let's talk about how many sons did he have? 5, mentioned in verse 22. And the significant one here is Arphaxad. Now, notice he mentions Shem as the father of all the children of Eber. Now, that's interesting. And when you get through studying on that, you'll still have some questions exactly who and what that refers to. It refers to the Hebrews, basically. Brother Willis, in his large work on the book of Genesis, suggests that the name, it was the name of the patriarch from which the name Hebrews was derived, but it was used in a broader sense than just the Israelites. So it was the descendants that became, out of which came the Hebrew nation, is basically it. So Shem was the father of the Hebrew nation, but broader than that, if that makes sense to you. Now there are 70 nations total, but out of that is going to be these nations that come from Shem. Now I want you to notice at verse 4, here's some significant ones we want to pay attention to. There is us mentioned at verse 23, from which there was a man that was a significant Old Testament character, came from the land of Uz. His name was? There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was? Job, yeah. All right. Now to Eber was born two sons. Now this is significant because we have a dividing point here. There was the two sons were, one of them was Peleg, which means division. That's what the name means. And his brother's name was Joktan. All right. Now there are two genealogies that are mentioned concerning the descendants of Shem. One goes through Joktan, mentioned in chapter 10. The second one picks up after the Tower of Babel story and goes through Peleg. Make sense? And so he deals with those two lines. Now, again, let's get ahead of ourselves to talk about. Right here is we're talking about Arphaxad and Selah and Eber. And then here's the two sons, Peleg, he's the one through whom the Messiah is going to come, and Joktan. We're focused upon Joktan right now. And so let's go back and look at our map here. Now, these are the nations that came from Shem. So go back to your little legend over here. So we're talking about this region right here are those that come from Shem. And that's where Abraham is going to be in the land of Ur. We'll talk about, we'll give another map with reference to that. They took in part of Arabia and part of what is now or later referred to as Asia Minor over toward Elam. That's the region which they took in and became all of those nations. Now, I want to go back to verse 25. His name was Peleg, which means, again, what? Divided or division. Now, there's some question as to what that means. It obviously is not, when it says the earth was divided, it's not the planet was divided, but it's the inhabitants and the people were divided. That's pretty obvious. As you look at references in chapter 6 and chapter 9 and chapter 11 and 18 and 19 and on down the line. Now, I won't trace all those references, but here's the big question. Some think it has reference. You say, well, obviously what it's talking about, since the land was divided, it's talking about that division that's mentioned in the next chapter as the people are divided concerning that. Willis makes this observation that there was evidence that he can cite, and he does, and I won't take the time to trace that, of divided languages before the time of Peleg. So that this event comes much later than this division of chapter 11. It may refer to that, but he's got a pretty good point. It seems that it may refer to the division between these two sons that we just talked about. And that is between Joktan and Peleg, that, and there was a dividing point between those families and the earth, the inhabitants were divided. And so here is the descendants that came through Joktan. That's what we're about to read. And then we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel, and then we're going to talk about Peleg. Does that make sense? That may be the division. Now, when you get through reading 10 commentaries, you'll have about three or four different interpretations of the division. What was it? It's the inhabitants dividing. Is it dividing of the languages, or is it the dividing of these two brothers, which seems to make more sense to me, or is it some other division among the people? I don't know. I lean toward it's these two brothers. But if you think it's talking about the events of chapter 11, 1 to 9. Have at it, and let's see if you can harmonize that. I'm not going to challenge that because on the surface, that's what I thought until I began to look a little closer. Now, let's talk about verse 31. I don't think there's a name here that is outstanding and significant that we need to stop and pay a lot of attention to. Till we get to verse 31, and it's not a name I'm looking for, but we have the same point being made again concerning that's not where I want to go, going back to this map. We see at verse 31 that they were divided according to their languages and their nations. So again, we have the significant number of nations that are scattered, some 70 nations that came from these three sons. Now let's get verse 32 and we'll stop for questions or comments. These are the families of the sons of Noah according to the generation in their nations, and from their nations were divided on the earth after the flood. Now, some of that division comes because of chapter 11. That makes sense? Now, were they supposed to be divided already? Yes. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But go ahead and flag, if you choose to, chapter 9 and verse 1. They were to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. They were to fill the earth, meaning they were to scatter. And so, don't all camp right here, but y'all scatter through the earth. Y'all fill the earth was the command God gave to Noah and his descendants. So y'all fill the earth. And so were they to be doing that? Well, they did, but not exactly like God wanted them to. They did it a little bit later when God forced it. And we'll see that in chapter 11. All right, questions or comments through chapter 10? Question number 3, what do chapters like chapter 10, ones filled with names and descendants, serve for us? What do we get out of chapter 10? All right, it does serve as a bridge. Show us how we got to where we are when we get to Abraham or to Noah, and then from Noah to Abraham, etc. Also shows us where nations came from. Now, there will be a nation, for example, that may not mean a lot to us now, but we'll come to a nation and we'll say, where did that come from? And maybe make reference back to here. Oh, that's a nation that came out of the descendants of Ham. Or that came from Japheth. That came from so on down the line. Make sense? Now, may not. For example, let's just go back to Uz. Uz may not mean a lot to us, but it will when we get to the book of Job. Here was a man from the land of Uz. Well, what is the land of Uz? Well, we can find the land of Uz on the map, and then we'll say, well, where'd they come from? Well, they came from the descendants of Shem. Make sense? All right. All right, let's go to chapter 11 now. See if we can make some sense of chapter 11. And so we have in chapter 11, the Tower of Babel and the descendants of Shem and Terah, who was the father of Abraham. Now, as an alternate, I call chapter 11, 1 through 9, the Tower of Babel, because that's immediately when chapter 11 is mentioned. If somebody says, let's turn in our Bibles chapter 11, you think, oh, that's the Tower of Babel. And it is. But the focal point is more on the dispersion of the nations than it is on the tower. Does that make sense? That's the focal point. We don't want to miss the point of chapter 11, 1 to 9. It's the dispersion of the nations. And so we have the building of the tower, then we have the confusion of the languages, verses 5 through 9. So let's see if we can make some sense of that as we go on. Let me see if we want to deal with a question here. Question number 4, what was man trying to accomplish in the tower, building the Tower of Babel? Question number 4. Trying to make a name for themselves. All right, something else. They are trying to, seems to be a sense of arrogance. They're forgetting about God, making a name for themselves, but there's something else they're trying to accomplish too. That's correct. That's part of the answer. There's more to the answer. Yeah, they're trying to keep themselves together and keeping from dispersing. And so there's a goal in that. So let's work our way through 1-4, the building of this tower. All right. Now the whole earth was of one language and one speech, but we just read about them having different languages. That's why I say some of this, or this happened before the complete fulfillment of all that's described in chapter 10. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. All right, so let's talk about the land of Shinar. This is where Nimrod had established a kingdom. Remember that? This is the land of Shinar right here in that that yellow little region right there. A little closer look, Shinar here. This is the land of Palestine. And then here's the Persian Gulf. And this is the land of Ur. We'll talk about it a little bit later. And then Shinar right here. That's Babylon. The city of Babylon is there. The nation of Babylon was founded there. We'll see more about Babylon a little bit later. So that's where we're talking about. And they dwelt there, and what did they say at verse 3? Let us make some bricks, and so they're going to an asphalt and mortar, and come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower. I'm not interested in getting into the details of this, but some of the commentators talk about it. Were they building a tower, or are they building a city with a tower? Well, seemingly a city with a tower, but the tower becomes the focal point. And whose top is to the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Let's go back to verse 4. There's two or three things to point out. They're building it to the heavens. Many of those in the, at least some of the scholars cite some ancient sources, that the higher man felt that he could climb. And if he built him something three stories tall, that he was closer to his God, and he was closer to the gods if he got three stories tall. But if he could go seven stories tall, he's even closer, and so he's getting closer to the gods, perhaps. Is that the idea here? I'm not sure. But they wanted to build a tower to the heavens, making a name for themselves. But I think the interesting point is, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. So this was an effort to keep man together. Now let's go back to chapter 9 and verse 1. Now, that's why I talk about chapter 11, 1-9 is more the dispersion of the nations than it is on the Tower of Babel itself, the tower itself. So let's go back to chapter 9 and verse 1. Man was told to fill the earth, which means they were to scatter. So the purpose of the tower was to prevent man from doing that very thing. This is rebellion against God. Does that make sense? They're again doing exactly what they want to do. This is the same problem in a different form that man had before the flood, doing what he wants to do and ignoring God. So they're trying to build a tower so that people rally around the tower and prevent man from scattering. So the story here, though we haven't got that far into verses 1-9, is not merely to explain the different languages. Some commentators will talk about, this is, God inserted this story here to tell where all the different languages come from. Well, it does that. But I don't think that's the main thrust of that. It's showing God's judgment upon man's defiance. Does that make sense? Man was defying God. God said, scatter. And they said, no. Let's build this tower and let everybody rally around it, lest we be scattered. So God confuses the languages. This is also, I hadn't thought about this, too. A writer today made this point, or I read from a writer today who made this point. This is also a story of grace, saving mankind from the evil that would have come from man being united. Now let's see if we don't see that in verses 5-9. So let's go ahead and work through this, and then we'll talk more about the tower. So the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Now, that's interesting. Now, I don't think that literally means God had to come down to see it, but here we have man functioning by himself down here, and God, in essence, the story is, came down, and God's going to intervene. That's the point. And so what does he do? Verse 6, he said, people are of one language, and this is what they begin to do. What does he say at verse 6? Yeah, As long as they're of one language, any rebellion they set out to do, they're going to pursue that. But if they were of different languages, they would not easily do that. Does that make sense? And so that's why I say this is a story of God's grace preventing man from doing much of the evil that he would have done by rallying together. Does that make sense? So it is a story of judgment, but it's also a story of grace, and it's a story of God dispersing the nations. That's what I want us to see. Not just, oh, that's the story. That's an interesting story that they built this tower, and that was kind of interesting. There's a purpose behind that. All right, now verse 7. So let us, this same phrase of let us make man in our image. This is God speaking, the Godhead. Let us go down and confuse the language that they might not understand one another's speech. So God used various nations and various languages to restrain sin. That's interesting. So you may think, boy, when we have three different nationalities together and one's talking in this language, one's talking that language, and we can't communicate, that's mass confusion. God used that very mechanism to restrain sin. That's interesting. Verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. That's the very thing he told them to do, chapter 9, verse 1. And then verse 9, they call this place Babel. What's Babel mean? Confusion. Because the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. Make sense? So these points right here I think are significant to our understanding of this story. Now, I refer you to Willis's work, excellent works, two volume, big, each book is about 1,000 pages each, something like that, on the book of Genesis. And he makes the point, as well as many other scholars, that the Tower of Babel probably was not something circular, as most suggest, or most artist renditions. But in most scholarly works, they'll talk about it was probably something like this because of some of the ancient ruins in Babylon were thought to be built after the Tower of Babel, that is, patterned after that, and that it was something built along this line. These two images are taken from some of the Logos software of a tower that went some 7 stories high. You can see, you may not can tell because of the smallness of it, the height compared to some large buildings or to a pyramid, which would be a little bit taller. But that man built this square type image and building a tower up about 7 stories high. And there are several ruins that are found in Babylon similar to that. And so it's thought that it may have been something of that fashion rather than a circular tower for what that may be worth. Several scholars talk about that, and I can refer you to those if you want to study a little more. That's about as much as I want to say about that in interest of time. All right. Now, anything on that before we go further to talk about the descendants of Shem? We've got to talk about that in the next 10 minutes. And Terah's descendants. Because we've got to get to Abraham, because we've got to know who Abraham is when we start into chapter 12 next time. So let's talk about Shem's descendants, verses 10 to 24, and see what we've got right here. Now, this is going to follow, if you haven't already made a note, Shem's descendants through Peleg. And so we're going to quickly go through this, not because it's unimportant, because I want to get down to the numbers here in just a second, see if we can make some sense of the numbers. Because the ages of when a person was born, the age of the father when the child was born, is not given in the other section of chapter 10. But when we come to this one, we start seeing the ages from the flood, that is Shem, who was in the flood, down to Abraham. And we know how many years it was. Now keep this in mind, because we're going to total this up in a moment. The flood took place, we think, 1656, from 1,556 years from creation. Does that make sense? So we're going to add some numbers to that and see where we are. All right, so let's get ahead of ourselves here. Here are the descendants that are given. Let's start right here. Here we have Shem, and then there's Arphaxad. that is mentioned here in this context, who is mentioned in chapter 10 and in verse 22. Then we start seeing the descendants from Arphaxad, and that is, there is Selah and Eber, and there's Peleg, and there's Reu. All right? And then we go from Reu to Serug and Nahor to Terah to Abram, who is Abraham. And that's all traced right here. Now, where I'm driving at is to get to these numbers right here. Starting at verse 11, or verse 10, Shem was 100 years old and he begat Arphaxad, and 2 years after the flood. All right? So you start taking the numbers here, and Arphaxad was born 2 years after the flood. So we take from the flood how many years later? And then we have Selah, who was born 35 years later. And then you have all these numbers that are given through down to Abram. Now, the age of Terah when Abram was born is the thing in question. So let's get that. Let's get over here to verse 26. Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And so immediately, some think that what that's saying is that what you have is 292 years, because you add these numbers up and you come to 292. The 70 years, pay attention to this little box here, is when Terah became a father, not when Abram was born. That makes sense? See, I was 25 years old when I started having children. But that doesn't mean I was 25 years old when Nathan was born, does it? And so if you've got four kids, you became a father here, but your third and fourth child was born much later. Same thing with Abram. Abram mentioned first doesn't mean he was the oldest. You say, how do you know? Well, let's take these two references right here. Genesis 11:32. At verse 32, let's get to the end, that the days of Terah were 205 years. So we know how long he lived, 205 years. Chapter 12 in verse 4 says that Abram was 75 years old, meaning you take the 75 from the 205, that's 130. So actually, Terah was 130 when Abram was born. So our total number of years, I think it to be 352. Somebody do the math on that and tell me if I'm incorrect. I'll stand corrected, but I believe I'm right about that. And that fits Klassen's chronology that I follow pretty closely. I don't always agree with everything Klassen said, but I like his chronology. And if you disagree with a little bit of the variation of numbers, I'm not upset about that, but I think I'm right about that. Does that make sense? So you take the 352 and add it to the 1656. Somebody check me on that. I think that's 2008. So we're looking at about 2,000 years, a little more than 2,000 years, since creation to the time of Abram being born. Make sense? Everybody confused? Is everybody in Exodus 4? Y'all look confused. Does that make sense? I see a couple of calculators out, so maybe we'll be corrected on those numbers here in a minute. But anyway, that makes sense, I think, to me. Now, let's talk about Terah and his descendants. And by the way, 1 Chronicles chapter 1 gives this same genealogy a little bit later. And so if you don't have a marginal note, maybe you might want to make a marginal note that 1 Chronicles 1 gives that same genealogy down to Abram. All right, we've got time to talk about the descendants of Terah. And what's interesting about this is we need to take note of the fact that's not mentioned here, but Joshua 24:2 says that Terah was an idolater. He's steeped in idolatry. And so that's important for us to understand, I think. And what do we learn at verse 28, that Haran died before his father Terah in the native land of Ur of the Chaldees. All right? Now, here's again the Ur of the Chaldees. This is where they were, and we're going to see them make their way up to Haran. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But His premature death may suggest that he was the oldest, not Abram, as you would think from verse 26. I don't think that's the case, that he was the oldest, because of harmonizing chapter 12, verse 4, with 13, or 11 and verse 32. Now, verse 31, no. Let's go back to verse 29. What do you learn from verse 29? Say again. Married within the family. Where's what I'm looking for? Yes. Remember, Abram's going to say later that Sarah was his sister. Wasn't a full-blooded sister. She's a half-sister. And so the shared father, but had different mothers, as this text, verse 29, says. She was barren, had no child. Verse 31, he took Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran. He's going to be a key player a little bit later by chapter 14, 13 and 14. And they went up from the Ur of the Chaldees. They didn't leave the Ur of the Chaldees at the command of God. That didn't come to chapter 12. But they went up from the land of the Ur of the Chaldees. And so why were they doing that? I don't know. Some think maybe this was a beginning of a break from idolatry. You say, well, that's a little conjecture. It's a lot of conjecture, maybe. But I'll give you that. But it may have been, and we'll just leave it at that, there may have been the family kind of breaking from idolatry a little bit, getting away from some of the terribleness of idolatry. I don't know, and I'm just going to leave it at that. And then verse 32 ends on the note that he lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. So what we have, by the time we get to the end of chapter 11, is you have them coming from here, and then Terah dies up in the land of Haran, and then we're ready to roll into chapter 12, God giving a promise to Abraham. And the focal point's going to be on that nation from here on out. Make sense? All right, let's go to question number 8. Practical things you learn from this chapter, or chapters, plural. Yes. It's not like, you know, not a fairy tale. Once upon a time, far, far away land, he had a bunch of children and they made many different nations. These are very specific nations. For example, you can see right here, the Israelites is what we're going to focus on, but these are very specific nations that came out. I won't read those to you. You can read those for yourself. But these are the nations that came from these descendants. And that's what we learned from chapter 10 and 11. Good point. What else do we learn from these two chapters? Good point. God accomplished his "let us," but they did not. Good point. What else? Take home with you. Chapters 10 and 11. Good point. Good point. One more. Good point. Good point. Yeah. And notice God kept it. That's a good point. And notice God kept his promise, because he said, I won't destroy this world again by flood. He didn't. But he came down and confused them and scattered them. And there was some judgment for their sin, but he didn't do what he could have done, destroyed it again with a flood. But he didn't do that. We're going to stop right there. Chapter 12, we begin now. The camera's going to zero in on the nation of Abraham, the descendants of Abraham. And so we're through with universal history, and we're about to focus on one family from here on out.